substance equals burn. The propaganda's a win, stress feeding on my tension. My countrymen, they love their fiction. Words are now displayed with good intentions.
Welcome to 1 in 200, the New Zealand politics media podcast. Sometimes we analyze shit, sometimes we do kind of independent shit. We do all kinds of stuff. It's such fun. Welcome everybody. On the line we have me, Philip, your co-host. We have two other co-hosts with us today. How are you doing, PMAX?
Good. Recently moved, nicely settled in. Yeah, I mean, you know, personal life going great, but as we'll talk about today, maybe things on the outside of my personal sphere not going too excellent.
It's good to have that balance, right? It's Maslow's hierarchy of hate or something like that.
Yeah.
Simone, how are you?
It's hard to pick one bad thing that's been going on, you know. That's difficult. But otherwise, I mean, like, I'm healthy and I'm thankful for the small things, you know.
Fresh new hells. So today we're going to talk a bit about PMAX's baby, no pun intended, education. And then see where the world takes us. There's plenty of hateable stuff this week, so unlikely we'll get a chance to get our love hats on. So we may be in full hater mode today. We missed a week, so hopefully you've missed our rage-filled dulcet tones in your ears. Welcome back. We had all sorts of diseases and activities in which people were engaged. Sorry, we have lives. If you want us to do more, join the podcast. Come on, give us a DM or an email. Come on the podcast. Join us. Join our club. So PMAX, you've been ranting a little bit about education, young and old. Why don't you kick us off with some thoughts?
Yeah, so this isn't exactly new news. Ugh, hate that particular confluence of words. But recently we had some academics pop out to voice their opposition to the early childhood changes. Fans of the show will know that I've talked about this before. This is in reference to the Ministry of Deregulation's actions to sort of change some things around early childhood regulations. And we've had a group of basically New Zealand's leading early childhood academics come out and say, hey, could we please sort of stop these changes? And once again, I mean, it's been talked about before, but you go through the changes that are being recommended, and even a literal child could tell you that these changes are not about improving the quality of early childhood education, which is something that the Honourable Regulations Minister has insisted since its inception. The two big changes that this group has highlighted are reducing the licensing criteria for the curriculum and reducing the amount of qualified early childhood educators in a early childhood centre. And one of the things that does get a little bit annoying about sort of, I guess, like mass media amplification of changes in education is they'll use words like curriculum or system of qualifications that might not necessarily be fully processed by your average media Joe Bloggs punter. But broken down, essentially what's being recommended here is that early childhood education not have a serious curriculum, basically just allow those centres to sort of choose whatever the fuck they want to teach and to allow whoever the fuck to teach them. And it's proven, there are numerous articles on this, numerous articles, journals, all sorts, that a good early childhood education makes a huge difference in a child's development, especially in nations like New Zealand, where there's a high disparity between different groups of different communities of people. Communities that can't afford to have the same level of at-home care that wealthier families do, being able to have a efficient, high-quality early childhood sector allows those children to enter at the same level in primary. It's sort of like a delivering on the equity incomes, attacking early childhood like this, and essentially literally changing our early childhood education into just daycare is a move that will generate a lot of money for those childhood centres that have personal and financial ties, allegedly. I'm just saying that because I don't have the information in front of me, to certain parties that might be enforcing this legislation. But yeah, kind of lost my thread there on the rant. But
they do, though. I mean, you don't need to be worried about people coming after you for saying that, because there's plenty of paper trails of the big ECE corps donating money to right-wing parties and, you know, dining with them and such. Can we dig in just briefly when you say that sounds like, well, two things. It's good to have you talking about ECE on the regular podcast instead of on your wild rides, because it means I get to butt in with questions that I think less education literate people might have. So just two things. One is that the push for a more, it sounds like what you're saying is there's kind of a push to deregulate and kind of relax standards around whatever passes for a curriculum. I think most of our listeners probably aren't very au fait with what that even means below the age of kind of 5 or 6, right? So it'll be useful to know what that means on like a practical level. And then the second thing is, doesn't that conflict with the at least kind of comms push from the National Party coming in saying, you know, an hour of reading, an hour of writing, we should go back to the basics, like more structured education at a school level? Does that, is there a conflict there, or is...
So this is where there's a very canny, this is something I've observed, there's a canny sort of division of labor between ACT and National, where National has come in hard with their back to the basics sort of messaging on primary schools, but that is focused on primary schools and to a lesser extent secondary schools. ECE has just been thrown to ACT Party to manage, and so ACT is sort of allowed to sell this lowering of quality without sort of open conflict with National. It's sort of taking advantage of a popular misunderstanding of early childhood education, where people are like, oh, well, you don't really learn anything until you start primary school. But a lot of that stuff is sort of foundational skills, stuff as simple as toilet training. Thankfully, we have a functioning ECE sector, so we're not getting the hellish stories that you get from places like the United States and the UK, where primary school teachers are having to teach children as old as like 10 or 11 how to use the toilet. Not to sound like a right-wing crank crying about like woke education or anything like that.
Kitty litter in the hallways, yeah.
Yeah, but it's just sort of like a lot of the basic skills on how to interact with your peers in an education setting, how to sort of be a person outside of your family home, are skills that won't be delivered as effectively by a less comprehensive curriculum, by less checks in on that curriculum, and by less experienced and trained practitioners. And it's really, really fascinating, because you can sort of see where the targeting is, because while at the same time as the ACT Party is pushing for all of these cuts to monitoring in early childhood education, they are increasing the monitoring in our public education system. So most notably recently with attendance data, where the government is now requiring every single school to submit their attendance data every single day, which is an increase in admin. It's an increase in admin that won't be able, it's not like schools can just bill the government more for that admin. It's just increasing the workload on teachers and admin staff without providing any extra resources to do it. And it's largely just going to, I don't know, it's going to show the same data. I don't know how more timely attendance reporting is going to shift poor attendance.
I've had it too easy for too long, PMAX. That's the thrust of what I hear you saying. What seems like, just politically, to, you know, put our politics spectacles on, like if you're right wing, it seems like something that you'd want to put the kind of the focus on, right? Is stuff like attendance allows them to have the kind of carceral drive of, see, it's these dumb kids not showing up to school. This is the problem with performance. And whether that happens or not, the emphasis on that is what matters for the right.
Yep.
Right? Like, that's the conversation they want to be having. They don't want to be having a conversation about school meals, which obviously came up with that disgusting photo of so-called food that Seymour's push.
It's also part of the potential forced charterization push, because this more granular attendance data will allow schools, predominantly schools where students have extra struggles outside of school life, highlight those schools with lower attendance to increase the chances of being able to smoothly transition into a forced charterization. I saw some data, don't know how accurate it was, that the current charter schools program only has 300 kids enrolled to the tune of 80 grand per kid, which is approximately eight times as much.
I'll tutor two kids for 160k.
Yeah, it's sort of a ridiculous sort of
Jago changing careers.
Oh no, that was quick. Good stuff.
Sorry, how many minutes in?
Leave that in there. Leave that in.
But yeah, and it's just kind of like, I don't know, it's, yeah, I mean, that was sort of like a throwaway comment, but imagine if our public education system was getting funded to the tune of $80,000 per student. The miracles that are already achieved at the current rates of funding are already really impressive. And I mean, I don't want to make any super solid predictions, because who knows, some of the charter school providers seem like they're half decent education providers, but I doubt that the results will be worth the investment, and they're not going to be eight times better than in the public system.
Like, yeah, I mean, this is with the problem with these thin end of the wedge programs that the right bring in, is that they say, oh, look at the results. You know, essentially, if you made a comparison the other way around, if you were introducing a public school system and you had five, you know, and you were judging the concept of public education based on ones who'd managed to jump through a bunch of hoops and were in the richest areas or had the most support and were being funded X times more, it's not a systemic comparable way, right, to think about a system. So of course, when you test these programs, you're going to get some that do well, partly through the political focus and the emphasis and the need for them to do well on a comms level, and also partly because that's kind of the nature of the beast. That's who's going to rise to the top. When you bring in a new program, there's always going to be some drive, regardless of the kind of structure. There are going to be people who are, you know, will wake up every morning and work for 16 hours on their new little business, which is basically what it is, right? A charter school model. Like, of course, you're going to have insanely driven people there first. But the problem is, once you roll that out into a systemic challenge to public education, that it undermines the validity of everyone else. And most of them aren't going to be like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, not to completely shift onto charter schools, but I think last year's charter schools are sort of the flashy, let's get these ones out to sort of get some positive press going in. There's lots of diversity, some exciting programs and so forth. I am predicting that this year we are going to see the sort of hatchets come down, and there may be multiple large public schools that are forcibly charterized in an attempt to sort of boost the numbers of students under a charter school system, undermine the PPTA, and just sort of try and entrench the system to an extent that an opposition party, even if they get in 2026, they can't dislodge that establishment.
Yeah. I mean, does it take much work to wind that back?
Well, so last time we had the charter schools experiment, Labor ditched it as soon as they got in. One of the few good things, I guess like the Ardern prime ministership did have more than a few good things, but it was one of the few good things that they did swiftly. But it was easy then because there were not many charter schools. They were relatively small and they were all heinously underperforming. If larger schools are charterized, if we're looking at a state public school with 1,000, 2,000 students that gets charterized, that is going to be more difficult to unpick. There's going to be a cost in reintegrating that in the public system. We've seen some schools sort of reorganized over the years. It's always a nightmare because there's just literally not the funding to do it properly. And it's essentially sort of like burning the ships, this forcible charterization. And it's what we've seen overseas in the States and in the UK, where you just make the system too big to fail. You make it so that the state has to support the system and support those private profits rather than going back to a fully public system. Ultimately, I mean, in an electoral system, the only way you're going to get a a truly great education system is either through some sort of unholy alliance like you got in Estonia. And you'll note if you follow Luxon and Erica Stanford's comments on overseas countries, Estonia is always a country they point to without wanting to learn the lessons of. Estonia basically just had a bipartisan don't fuck with education. They let educators sort of manage the education system for a decade, and now they're getting really good results because it's an investment in time. It takes a long time for changes in education to manifest, which is really handy for the right wing because they can fuck with education and then wait until they're out, and then they can blame all the poor outcomes of education on the government before them. A lot of the negative things we're seeing around like literacy and numeracy currently can be directly traced to the national education policies before 2017. And when
Key
this,
government changes, right?
yeah, and
National
then
standards.
when the work that was done to fix them finally sort of manifests in the education system, you better believe that National's going to take credit for that and be like, oh, it's our back to basics. And I guess this is where we always go back to the 1 out of 200 favorite beating stick, but this is where the media needs to take some responsibility and report on the fact that these changes do take time, accurately trace the history of these things. Like, I don't even know, does the like if you were born in 2000 and you're an adult 2024, do you even know what tomorrow's schools is? Do you even know like the impact that that's had on New Zealand's education? You probably don't. And like, you know, I mean, not everyone's going to sit down, watch the media, read the media, but like even educated people don't really have an understanding of how New Zealand's education system operates and the issues within it and where those issues have come from. And the problem is, of course, like the PPTA is probably the best organization in the country doing research on a lot of this stuff because as sort of like the sharp end of the spear, sorry, NZDI, but you know, essentially the task of turning a intermediate school student into a functioning adult of society lies within the PPTA's purview. So they've been incentivized to do a lot of excellent research. I would encourage you to go to their website and look at some of the papers they've published over the years. But it's really easy to dismiss that if you're in the right wing bloc, even if you're in the Labour Party. Because it's like, oh, this is just whingy unionists trying to get more pay for teachers or something like that. But time and time again, their predictions of the PPTA and the trends that they identify are manifested in reality. And yeah, going back to media, there should be some level of reporting on that, some level of accountability. Like charter schools should never have gotten and should not be getting the absolute glazing they're getting by the media. They are purely a for-profit degradation of an education system.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even think. I can't think of any kind of investigative level of media analysis of education over time, right? And there's been some really interesting swings. Like, I'm not old enough to like think about tomorrow's schools on a daily basis. But like, when I was young, people were talking about Trevor Mallard changing the education system in the Clark government, and then after that, there was the kind of national standards key push, which, as you're saying, like we only saw over time. The damage that that did, and then the slight kind of wind back with the Ardern Labour years, and now we've got the back to quote unquote back to basics, which, as you say, will take what a decade for us to really see the result of that, and that's quite an easy kind of timeline to draw, right? Like it wouldn't take long for an enterprising David Fisher-esque journo in the Herald to just do like a timeline and be like, look, these are the effects that we've seen. The kids that we're seeing in at this period had this effect, and the kids that we saw come through this system had this effect. It's not a hard mission. We're not asking for the world here. This is like the work of probably an afternoon on a couple of research websites. But who's on the PPTA website? No one, right? No one's clicking on them, and you know, even out of the small number of people who read press releases and journo shit in general, no one's digging into education unless they are kind of already firmly in one camp, which is a problem, right?
Well, it's interesting because education journalism, like education stories, do well because parents are invested in the education of their children. and they pay attention to news around schools, news around education changes. Like, generally, parents are quite invested in what happens in education, but the actual reporting, the actual understanding of what matters in education is not being responsibly communicated by the government or by media. Like, I mean, this is my, like, if I was a dictator, democracy in a democratic society sort of thing, if there was one change I could make that would fix education, would be to abolish private schooling. If you abolish private schooling in New Zealand and everyone was forced to go through the public system, then you would see the requisite investment in that system, although you'd have to do some work around zoning, thanks to tomorrow's schools, but to ensure that everyone has a decent education. Because currently, the wealthiest people in New Zealand, and not even the wealthiest, even the sort of upper middle classes, can literally just opt out of the public education system. They don't need to pay attention to what's happening with education because they know that Sally and Billy are going to be able to go to a private school and they're going to be able to get an education that in their eyes is superior. And so they don't mind that the public sector is being thrown to the wolves. They're happy to keep donating to their political parties and lending their support to political parties, as unfortunately in our sort of oligarchic society, the most politically engaged class.
I mean, that's the right wing. That's the right wing playbook, right? As you run down the public sector and create private alternatives that both make profits and are the only option. I'm going to use this juncture to bring health into it because I think it's basically the same conversation, which is, you know, another necessary public good that's incredibly important and people really care about. And the National Party's announced their downgraded Dunedin Hospital. It was the, what, 35,000 strong Dunedin March, which was really impressive, record-breaking in terms of turnout and people caring about this kind of stuff. People do care about health. It's been a long time since a lot of these hospitals have been done up. There was already a crisis in Ardern. It was already a crisis during Key. Chronic underspending for decades. The current Dunedin Hospital has 367-ish beds. Labor's plan from 2022 was for 410. The Nats have committed to build one with 351, so fewer than the current Dunedin Hospital. And, you know, Simeon Brown did his Simeon Brown salesman thing and said, we've listened to the complaints and we can give you certainty. I played a game last night listening to his interview, his questions. He was giving the media and drink every time he says certainty or nationwide, I think was the other one. Because
how are you still alive?
Yeah. It's so he's such a PR guy, right? That's why you bring someone like that, wheel him into health, not because he has any health kind of qualifications. But I think he's trying to be the lid on it, right? He's trying to do the Tony Ryle thing of being able to kind of rebuff questions without making it a story. He's there to dissipate the anger around health, which I think is not clear that he will be unsuccessful in, because our media is so shallow, as you say, that they're not going to dig into anything. And if he keeps saying the same words over and over again enough, I wouldn't be surprised if most of the kind of press pack move on and give up on it. But the protests were about delivering the hospital as previously promised, not scaling it back. So the fact that he said, we've listened and we're scaling it back, was such a kind of perfect encapsulation of Luxonomics, right?
Yeah.
There's the salesman kind of repeat the same mantra long enough and it becomes the truth, right? And it just, when I was like, well, this is kind of what you'd expect out of the National Party. But then when Labour responded, I was like, this is an absolute scandal. Like, there is no good health representation in this country. Like, who is there to stand up for basic kind of public goods? So I just want to read the headlines of the NZNO, New Zealand Nurses Organisation, press release yesterday, Friday, 31st of January, 2:40 p.m. Scaled back new Dunedin Hospital puts cost cutting before health. It's kind of what you'd expect, right?
Yeah.
It's short-sighted. The southern community has a growing and aging population. We have a failing primary care health sector, which means more people will unnecessarily need hospital-level care. Disappointed but not surprised with today's announcement. The new build is outlined in the 2017 business case, was worked on by 500 clinicians. This government is intent on putting dollars before the people. That's a choice. This is the press release from the New Zealand Labour Party. Same day. Dunedin wins. Hospital build continues. The people of Dunedin have won an almost year-long battle to have their hospital confirmed, but Nationals' delays have cost dearly. Delays. That's what Labour's having a fucking cry about. Embarrassing. Labour, what is going on? You are the alleged party with union connections. The NZNO press release should be your press release. It's insane to me. Like, this is a golden layup for the Labour Party, right? If you're the Labour Party, you could not conceive of an easier news cycle to smash out of the park. You're the Workers' Party. You're the party who represents, you know, lower income workers. Workers, you're the Workers' Party, right? Allegedly. And the National Party has done what the National Party does by representing rich people and telling an entire corner of the South Island to get fucked, basically, right? As part of a narrative of underfunding drastically needed improvements to public infrastructure. This connects all of your issues that you could possibly talk about. You can talk about speed limits. You can talk about them being in bed with the tobacco companies, right? This is just a golden, like, they are holding the ball above the net for you and asking you to just touch it. Just give it a little tap, Labour Party. And Labour Party absolutely refused to do so. Insane to me. I genuinely don't get it, even from just a basic political management perspective. Like,
they don't want to win, because if you win, you have to govern, and they don't want to govern. They hate governing. Because you have to do things. You have to have ideas. And they just want the seats and the titles and the ribbons. You know, they're classic sort of centrist technocrats, or I don't know. It's kind of weird, because you can't really call a Labour a meritocracy or anything like that, because they don't have merit. But I think, for me, the thing out of it is, let that be a lesson. That think about your aims when organizing. The protesting was great that there were a lot of people. If your telos, if your end goal of that, right, is to try to get one of the electoral parties that has, major infrastructure in place, access to media channels and so on and so forth, to move and do something, let's consider that a dead strategy from now on, because it doesn't work. Because you can try to whip up numbers and say, look, there's all the support behind it. Now go, people that are supposed to be the apparatus for working people to represent us in parliament, go and do what you're supposed to do. They won't do it because they don't represent you. They represent their donors. They represent the rich. They represent tech. They represent everything except for you. You are somebody that they have to sop to and placate, kind of, sort of, or maybe try and trick and fool every 3 years. Labour doesn't give a fuck about you. I'm sorry. They just don't. So not that I think people were it was wrong to believe that, because I think that people want to believe the best. Like, you want to believe that you live in a democracy, right? You want to believe that you live in a country where if you show that there is major public support and, in fact, outrage about something that's going on, that the government will be responsive to it in some way, because in a healthy society, that is how it would work. In a healthy representative democracy, let's say, let's forget the idea of actual democracy, like, you know, constitutional, whatever, representative democracy, that kind of pale shade of democracy that we talk about, you know, under capitalism. Even that should respond to something like it, but we don't live in that anymore. If we ever did, I don't know, but it's important to kind of think about, what's your end goal? Does it end with people holding placards in the streets? Or does it have to go further than that and change and be kind of beyond that and take that energy and really funnel it into forcing National through other ways and means? And nurses in the recent past, have done incredibly well with that. Labour didn't want them to take organized action. Their bosses didn't want them to take organized action, but they did, and they succeeded in forcing Labour's hand under the last government. And that was a crucial lesson, that wildcat action works, that it's dangerous and risky. But if you have enough people behind you and we support each other and we build those networks to support each other, then we can get things done. And trying to show, you know, trying to do a march to parliament is a really good thing that's heartening and it has its uses. But that in itself, or, you know, a protest or walk down Dunedin, that in itself is not going to move the needle. Because the needle's not connected to anything. It's not connected to you, for sure.
Yeah, that's really opposite. Like, they also collected signatures, right? An approximately similar number of kind of signatures. And it just shows that in and of itself, as Simone's saying, that's not a win, right? Because look what happens. If you thought you were appealing to the majority, the party that is, what, the second biggest party. So if you take, you know, the National Party, the ACT Party, New Zealand First and Labour, they all seem complicit in this, right? They're basically all saying, get stuffed, you know, you don't need healthcare. And there was an article just a few days before that in RNZ, predictable beginning of health system collapse from General Practice Aotearoa. The shortage of GPs is so bad, doctors are being abused over wait times and closing their books to new patients. 36% of general practices are not enrolling new patients last year. There are major workforce shortages and underfunding. We know this, right? It's been going on for years and years and years.
Yep.
We're a so-called first world country without a functioning healthcare system. And, you know, over COVID, that was kind of glossed over because a lot of countries in the world were struggling. But we talked a lot about the dangers that are posed by an overflowing healthcare system. You know, if you have a few more people show up, suddenly a healthcare system that's already operating at 100% capacity, people start dying, right? It's real kind of existential shit for the people of a country where a healthcare system starts snapping. And we've been given all the warnings you could ask for the last over 5 years, right? Since the beginning of COVID lockdowns, there were doctors on the media saying we don't have the capacity to do this stuff. That's part of the justification for the elimination strategy, et cetera, et cetera. And instead of using that opportunity and huge huge public support, right, for supporting a massively underfunded public healthcare system, instead of using that as an opportunity to increase the capacity and increase that infrastructure on a historic wave of support, the Ardern government basically said, our goal is business as usual, which I got sick of saying every week on this podcast is an absolute historical failure of leadership. And I think we're seeing the result of that now, because that was our last government who on the surface gave a shit about public health, right? This government
that
had SOPs. Sorry. To say, you know, specific things like the Dunedin Hospital will get finished. But we're seeing the result of that, right? They're lying on the face of it. And as Simone's saying, we don't like the rage that people feel about an underfunded and unacceptable public healthcare system where you can't enroll in a new GP because they don't have capacity. GPs in areas that are underserved are having to increase their prices, which means fewer people will end up going, which means more preventable public health issues will come up, which means more people need to go to hospitals, which, as we're learning, won't exist and won't have the beds to serve them. People will die in the streets. And our rage isn't connected to anything, as Simone's saying. I think that's really dangerous. You know, we're pulling on that lever of public support. We're saying thousands of people care about this issue, and Labor's going, so what?
Sorry, there are so many things, and it's hard to touch on all of them. But I guess what you were saying at the end, it does make me think that because that's not connected with anything, and because people aren't allowed to be politically educated, there will just be a kind of, if I can put it a certain way, kind of unrest for people who aren't represented anywhere, don't have anything. That in itself will make, you know, to again borrow from sort of earlier Marxist terminology, kind of the petty bourgeoisie of this country, right? Or, you know, what sometimes gets called the middle classes, although that's sort of a meaningless term, get threatened when they see unrest in the people below them, because their only comfort, even though they don't, you know, rule the society, is that there are people who are still underneath them, right? And that causes fascist backlash. So Labour in doing this is contributing to fermenting exactly the sort of slide towards what is happening in the United States here. And that in itself is reason to scrap the party, if, you know, it were possible to just click our fingers and do that, right? Because it's dangerous for Labour to exist for that reason, in the form that it does. Or, you know, there are people who believe in entryism and so on and so forth, and I won't dissuade them from that, because if they succeed, I mean, hell yeah, that's good for all of us, right? But I will say that in itself is something we need to kind of be cognizant of, I think, the wider implications of what's going on with all of this. The other thing as well is, you know, as long as we don't have a fully universal public national system of health that covers everything, including, you know, eyes, teeth, and so on and so forth, as long as there is the stratification, as long as it is legal for there to be health insurance, then people who are from not only the kind of wealthier strata of society, but also politicians who have access to such things, will not care about the state of the health system, because it won't be real to them. It won't actually touch them. It is the universal aspect of it, the fact that if there's no such thing as private schools, if everybody has to go into the public system, if everybody has to have the same healthcare, then those things improve because the people who are in power are forced to to use them, right? This is one of the reasons behind universalization, beyond all of the other good reasons behind it. But it is worth considering that. Something that was brought up, I'm just tangenting for a second, by, I think it was, it might have been Rashbrook, about New Zealand having historically low, not historically low, sorry, among the OECD, low debt levels. They say we can't build, you know, any more health infrastructure, but the truth is that we can. It's just that there is an artificial ceiling that's put on the amount of infrastructure, on the amount of investment that we have to put for our national infrastructure in all respects and in all departments of the government, except for, you know, the money for consultancies and so on and so forth. Sorry, Jenny, but I think that Philip's laughing. But these are all choices, right? And it's not like it will be easy. I have an extended family member who is being high up in a lot of, but particularly the kind of indigenous side of the public service, where, you know, the government will, or the department will kind of go to these groups within the departments and be like, you need, is this treaty compliant? You know, sign off on this. And like, we've already decided what it was going to be, but, you know, just like tell us that we're doing a great job. You know, we Pākehā are actually ruling and running the things, right? You know, he's sort of, that's his position, right? In a lot of these departments, he's been across most of the public service, and he noted that Labor was trying to, in a way, transform the health sector during the pandemic by saying, you know, we're going to have all of these different ones that are siloed into different things. We have to combine them. We have to, you know, create this kind of, I suppose, not necessarily mega system, but it has to run differently. And we're going to change all of this. And that was a kind of technocratic solution to it without putting in nearly enough of the funding that was needed, or giving the timescale, or having everything else that's requisite and the constellation around that, or rather the cogs around that, that sort of central cog to actually make it run. Because what you need is, you know, if you want to build things, you have to have a Ministry of Works. We keep saying this sort of thing, right? You have to have the in-house knowledge and understanding to be able to build infrastructure. You have to talk about, you know, if we're going to bring all of these things in-house, how do we have, you know, a nationalized ambulance service? How does that sort of integrate with everything else? With our computer systems, we are farming out and shelling out huge amounts of money to overseas tech services to purchase these kinds of products. Do they integrate with each other? I don't know. But, you know, let's just buy more and more stuff from Silicon Valley and hope that, you know, this happens. And this is all partially privatized. And there is this huge series of little octopuses sucking onto the public by taking that kind of contract money, when really all of the stuff should be able to be undertaken by the state, because that's what the state is. Otherwise, what's the point in having it? You know, if you're going to be a social democrat about it, be a social democrat, right?
This is, I think that, like, what you've touched on there is something that I think most people are aware of. Like, most people have this general ill will towards government spending in general, because they're like, oh, it's just a waste of money. Because they recognize that, wow, the government spends this many billions of dollars and my life just keeps getting worse and worse every year. And it's going back again to the old beating post, but it's a failing of media, it's a failing of the Labour Party, and even to an extent the Green Party, for not highlighting that, like, yeah, most of this government spending is just like fitted away in working groups and consultancies and all that kind of thing. It's just kind of like, yeah, like, people know that that money is being wasted, but no one is sort of highlighting, like, yeah, this money could not be being wasted, this money could be spent on more valuable outcomes.
Part of that is media failure, right? It should be incumbent upon reporters, when National says, oh, we're getting rid of the grift and gravy train, to say, well, actually, your governments will always just reduce in-house government capability and then farm it out to your mates who own consultancies.
Yes, it's as simple
pay
as
top dollar.
When National proposes cutting something or changing something or getting rid of something or whatever, the question journalists should have, and should not stop until it is answered, is how are you going to replace that? 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 Instead of just accepting, like, oh yeah, okay, there is like $80,000 worth of waste in the public sector, and we're just gonna like accept that narrative.
Yeah, and I think, like, to do the classic Philip thing and say, to be fair, to hand it to the media. I think there were some attempts to do that before the last election, with especially with Luxon, because he's not very good at his job, right? But it wasn't a narrative pushback, it was a style pushback. It's just because he's not a very good politician, that there were openings and kind of attack lines that made themselves available. But I think you're totally right from a kind of a consistency perspective and an ideological perspective, that it's not something that occurs to most journalists when they're interrogating ministers or MPs or political campaigns. They're looking for internal inconsistencies. They're not looking for gaps in the kind of political trajectory that these parties are on, because, you know, we're not saying that Labour didn't do this. They farmed stuff out to consultancies and they didn't build the capacity of the state to take on these kind of projects, which you need for a serious kind of nation building project, I guess, to be kind of cheesy about it.
If something is broadly agreed upon by the National and Labour parties, it is a universal fact in our media, right?
Yeah. And
even if it doesn't match reality.
Yeah, exactly. And if you say, well, why can't we do that? For some reason, that's treated as a weird perspective instead of, you know, the necessity of millions of dollars per year going to these so-called specialists, right? Business cases and what have you, for things that should be part of our kind of national fabric, right? It's not, this isn't like complex one in a century kind of events that we're talking about. We need to fix and rebuild a substantial amount of the CapEx and the infrastructure behind our health and education, which are some of the most important parts of having a country, right? This is really like foundational stuff. Like PMax was saying at the beginning, like education spending is not just too low, but a lot of it's in the wrong places. Emphasis is in the wrong places. And I mean, we're saying the same thing about health. And I think it's too easy for, I guess, what you could generously constitute as the left in New Zealand to have this kind of social democratic defensive union style posture, right? And say, oh, stop cutting X. We don't, like, it's unacceptable to cut Y. And these are the big kind of protests and moments, really. It's not like, even protests might be too generous. These are the kind of moments, generative moments that we see in the media, is always when something gets attacked. But there's not enough putting forward a vision of, you know, what would it be like to have a functioning education system and a functioning healthcare system that worked for everyone, even poor people. Like that sounds very basic, but there's very little of that on the public radar, right? The only time we hear about what nurses want, it's when they're picketing, saying we can't function under these conditions. So there's this kind of empty space, I think, this void, where you could attack and say, this is what we want, right? Even when Labour or the Greens do have a kind of social democratic vision statement or a campaign before an election year, there's very little this, you know, this is what we want. There's a lot of, we need to stop cutting this. We need to fund this 2% more. You know, this should, at best, you get kind of, this should keep pace with inflation, or, you know, X more hospital beds, X more cancer surgeries, whatever it might be, ED times. Should decrease in the case of health. But we don't get much kind of, not exactly even big picture, but just material, you know, this is what our health system should look like, which you kind of do get from the right, I think. Like, they're better at connecting those material realities. As Simone was saying before, like, referencing Estonia, or it might have been PMax, I forget. Referencing
that was
country.
Saying, yeah.
That was you, sorry. But with reference to education,
Stolen
right?
Valor.
Yeah, it was. But like, look at this country, you know, and they do a lot of look at Singapore. They're doing a lot of look at Ireland, but it's copying, and it's not exactly inspiring, but at least they have something, right? They're offering something. But you don't really see that much from the kind of electoral left in New Zealand, and even less so from the kind of movementist left. Like, where's that energy? I think that's a really key kind of lacking.
The identification of them as defensive, I think, is really prescient, because they don't put forward any sort of vision for the future. And we even see this with like the Green Party. I still remember when they did their big Green New Deal manifesto, whatever it was, and one of the key points of it was like not creating more jobs or anything like that, but making a working group to investigate how to make more jobs. And it's like, that doesn't inspire anyone. I'm not going to vote for that. I don't want to vote for that. I want to, like, just get up there and say, we're going to make jobs, or we're going to do this. Like, yeah, describe the action, the outcome you want, and say you're going to do it. Leave the details for after you've got power. like the sort of and going to education, healthcare, and honestly even emergency services, like all of these areas are heavily underfunded. And I mean, maybe Te Pāti Māori, I haven't looked into their policies or anything, but like no party really has a vision for like, yeah, we're going to actually like redress the 20 years of underfunding here. The best you get is we're going to arrest the collapse or maybe slightly improve things. Like these things need colossal investment, and the state has the capacity to do it, as you were talking about with the debt levels. And we see that the state's perfectly happy to spend $500 million on fucking vape pens, but not willing to make those kinds of investments on fucking hospitals in Dunedin or actual lasting infrastructure. Like, it's shocking how much of the country is still operating on infrastructure that's 40, 60, 80, 100 years old. And just sort of like, yeah, we've got the national government ACT Party looking to figure out ways to sort of leech what they can off that remnant. And then there's also just the electoral left is basically at best willing to arrest that development and then sort of set up for the next round of sell-offs.
This might be a spicier take than normal, but I just don't think that's unions' jobs in New Zealand. I don't think you can rely on unions to create a vision for society in New Zealand, because they've not just that they've been, massively attacked and worked down since at least the beginning of the 90s. We all know the history of neoliberalism and the destruction of union kind of movements as a as an institution, but not just that, but they just don't fulfill that function currently. Like, I don't think you can look at NZNO, where I read that piece of their press release about the health changes, for example, and say now they should offer us a positive vision going forward. Like, I don't think you can put that at the feet of unions usefully, because that kind of is their job, right? To defend their membership. They're representing their membership. They're not representing the, let's say, 50,000 more nurses that there should be, right? That's a subsequent vision to what is currently in their headlights, and I just don't see where that's going to come from if not an electoral project, or at least a political project of some kind, right? And you were talking about the kind of Green New Deal style vision that the Greens released. I thought it was awesome that they did that. Like, that's a progress step. Fuck am I talking about? A step forward. But you're right, the substance in it was pretty kind of meager and wasn't getting anyone out of bed in the morning, kind of, campaigning on the streets. And the kind of thing we need is people that unify, something that unifies people in all of these similar struggles with their particularist kind of demands around education being worked down, health being worked down, massive kind of public sector aggression without a kind of electoral, political. Component to it necessarily. But I mean, Gary Pienda is doing, like, basically on a one-man crusade to kind of restore sanity to the health discourse. But he's not on One News every night, right? Old people aren't listening to him. He's done some great interviews with, like, Bernard Hickey and Big Hairy News and a few other, like, independent spots. But just basic kind of facts. And you can communicate this stuff really clearly and easily, but apparently people don't, right? People don't want to. That's not what's in the news. It's wild to me. And, like, these stories come and go. We get the shit in the walls story about a hospital, and then instead of that being an ongoing kind of rolling national scandal, we need to hear about whichever new MP's, like, personal drama for the 20th time, or whatever else. But I guess it's easier, right? It's you can't just scrape Twitter and Blue Sky and then come up with a 10-minute story. You need to actually research one thing to write a story about this stuff. It's wild. It's wild.
It's a bit of the Roni coffee.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Pause for Ronan.
Yeah. If you're wondering why Philip is so going hard out for a better health system, it's a very personal thing, I think, at the moment.
Suddenly it's important, yeah.
Yeah, suddenly, yeah, this is this week, that'll be the important thing. But then
Yeah,
another week.
yeah.
Are you right? And I think this is kind of the IWW thesis, right? One big union, and there's perhaps a reason why Wobblies were huge in New Zealand and was one of the founding centers, I think. Partly because we're a small enough country that, you know, it can kind of even make sense to have, you know, this kind of syndicalist way of viewing things. But while that is not in union capacity, and they would have to almost, not fundamentally, but deep down into the bones of them, be different things than they are presently, I don't think it's not like it's impossible for that to exist. It's just that you have to have a broader view. You have to have political education with unions, and you have to also, like, it's useful that the infrastructure is there. And perhaps, you know, this is something that people ought to turn their minds to, is how do you have something that is more holistic and less solely focused on just what is the next negotiation and pay round? And also, you know, how do we sort of, or not necessarily how do we, but just, you know, management of the unions being very comfortable with, you know, national level kind of parliamentary managerial sort of systems, if you want to think about it that way, you know, kind of buddy-buddiness at the top. So some people talk about the kind of democratization, further democratization within unions, which is sort of broadly democratizing forces, but have to a great extent, just because this is what happens when you sort of lose power, have ossified New Zealand. And I think that that's right, but there is also the possibility, which, as you note, Philip, doesn't exist currently, of kind of broadening what it means for that to exist, right? Because if you look at different experiments that have existed around, and I don't mean experiments in the sense that they were just hypothetical, I just mean because, you know, new ways of human living have kind of always been being tried, even though, you know, the present state of things attempts to tamp down on them. You can look at really early and perhaps even pre-revolutionary Russia, for examples of how workers' councils were broader than just talking about, you know, workers' conditions or the way that Soviets operated. And these are kind of broader than just, you know, again, the pure material pay interest or conditions interest of the workers who are within those organizations. They also tend to think a little more broadly than that, and they're interconnected with each other, right? So these are different models that have existed and can exist. And when there are those ruptures, things can be very exciting. I mean, you know, you think about 1917 and immediately into 1918, there were, you know, like orchestras in the Soviet Union that did away with conductors for a bit, because they were like, heck, let's just try it with just us, you know, like, you know, no bosses. And there are all sorts of these things that seem almost like silly now, but people were very excited to try new things. And I think that vision of the future is part of it. You have to create that vision by what you're doing within it. To create the kind of broader societal vision, there also has to be within the kind of revolutionary apparatuses of that kind of vision itself. That just doesn't exist yet. But if you think long term, that is where the difference lies, right? Like, that doesn't happen in New Zealand right now. It can't happen in New Zealand right now. There are so many different matches that are being lit and thrown on the tinder, but we don't have enough wood for the bonfire yet, so they're kind of going nowhere. But if you think longer term and you think about what, you know, union structure is and how interconnected, you know, syndical structure is, or perhaps, you know, Soviet structure, or perhaps, you know, workers' council structure, right? Like, all of these different things, media apparatus, social media apparatus, everything, all different kinds of networking, right, and future building, those things have to be almost microcosms in themselves of what future looking can be. You have to have it, because otherwise, how can you create that? How can you create a society that has a future if within the small institution which is trying to take that over doesn't have it in itself? You just have to. You know, and I think you're quite right that that doesn't exist. I think it can. Whether it should or whether it shouldn't is a kind of strategic question, right? And there are many people, and of course, I think most of the union people who do very good work and have come on this podcast and talked, you know, many times before, would believe that this is something which can be changed from the inside. And there are others who consider that it can't be done. So that is part of the question. And I think it is an open question that everybody has different opinions on, but something has to be done. And the question is, what is to be done?
What I would say, just to tie in with a bunch of this, is the PPTA has a vision for New Zealand's education future and has negotiated on that sort of vision. But it's sort of the material reality is, at the end of the day, with negotiations, the union is going to have to make choices that ultimately the membership decides. And when you're negotiating, unfortunately, the first thing that goes is the future, because teachers got to eat. It was worse in some earlier negotiations where provisions for beginning teachers were thrown out by the majority of practicing teachers who were near the top of the scale, who just wanted more of a pay bump for themselves. That didn't happen as much with the last round of negotiations, but there's lots of things that the PPTA will push for. So for example, paid training for teachers, incentives to get more people to join the teaching profession, protections to ensure people stick around after the first few years of teaching, that the government will ultimately trade away for, be like, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do this. And this is, you know, the Labour government in the last set of elections, famously Chris Hipkins absolutely demolishing the negotiations to try and just save a buck, I guess. Yeah, sorry, just my two cents.
No, I think that's the kind of conversation we're going to have more. And I don't know, I think we need to be more ruthless with the function of unions in society than we being the kind of broad left. Because like they're crucial, and I think we need to treat them as a serious kind of institution worth both improving and therefore interrogating, right? Exactly what function are they fulfilling? And yeah, I mean, as Ewan and Simone were saying, like there are a hell of a lot of good people in unions doing a lot of good work, but a lot of that ends up being that kind of defensive posture, right? By necessity. But if that's all they're doing, I think that's a hiding to nothing. So if your kind of philosophical position, I guess, is, you know, repeat everything unions say, then that ends up putting you at odds with building that kind of cohesive vision for the future, I think. And that's something that I've observed in the left over the last kind of decade in New Zealand, is that even the best operators politically often end up at a bit of a dead end where they say, well, my opinion is what Union X says, because that's Union X's kind of space, right? It's kind of a an epistemic kind of dead end, I think, because they go, look, this is the realm of nurses, therefore NZNO is right. This is like the domain of teachers, therefore TPPA, like that's who we have to listen to, right? And if that's the extent of your ideology is platforming someone else, then I think you're missing out on building a future that you can bring people into, and it ends up as an inherently diminishing role for those like crucially important parts of public society. And I think that's been really dangerous accidentally, like with the best will in the world, right? These are like very smart, articulate, like some of the best people in New Zealand, I think, suffer from this kind of aggrandizement of self-destructive kind of positionality on the role of the union, which, you know, doesn't make me very popular, but I do think it's a problem.
The standpoint, I mean, we fetishize it, right? Because we don't have it and it doesn't function.
Yeah.
And so we fetishize and romanticize what existed in the mid-20th century to the exclusion of most of the indigenous population. And I think what you're saying is very true. The kind of standpoint epistemology, that really vulgar sort of faux philosophy that gets co-opted as thought terminating. Sometimes, you know, worst bad actors, like right-wing actors, kind of name one of the flavors of it liberal idpol, and they are in bad faith about that. But they are cottoning on to something which, you know, I'm going to be Philip, and I don't have to hand it to them, because I think left thinkers have much better and incisive analysis of it. But standpoint epistemology is thought terminating, and it can't really be useful, because ultimately what that means is under capital, where, you know, the sort of voices that end up being the loudest and that you will hear the most often through channels that are, again, have the infrastructure and the means of communication and dissemination controlled by capital, are going to be the ones that enfold you back into capitalism. So like the ideology that it ends up as is always going to be one which doesn't function to do that. Like institutions don't build in self-destruct mechanisms. There are contradictions within them, but they always try to protect themselves, right? And the kind of political economy of New Zealand is in itself, and situated within a large global meta institution, and you have to be aware of that and understand how that works. And unions are part of that. They are part of kind of capitalist compromise in a way, right? And this isn't to take away from that, but just I think you're quite right. Uncritical glazing is a real problem. And I mentioned the past when I talk about, like, for example, the Russian Revolution as an historical example, because I think that, not because the past is where the answers lie. In fact, quite the opposite. It's just an example of how experiments work. New Zealand is a very different system. Like Aotearoa has, like we have Te Ao Māori, right? Like we have hui, we have other ways of connecting, the kind of and ways of understanding and being. And Pākehā are not going to be at the center of that and shouldn't be. But the indigenous ways of organizing and understanding the world and reorienting ourselves as a society and our means of production, our means of communication, dissemination, everything, right? The way that we all collectively exist is different. And it's different to be manuhiri in a place, I think, right? You know, and there are all these things that are different. And so we have to understand that there are different solutions and there are different ways of organizing and there are different ways of structuring what your future is going to be and improving your present is going to be. And we have to be alert to those things. And unions are part of that, but they're not the whole picture. And if they are not useful, they need to be changed until they are, right? Or scrapped and restarted, you know, whatever that kind of means or works. Because there are self-defeating aspects to them. I think, you know, PMAX sort of very rightly kind of noted that, you know, those material circumstances, like, those are really important and pay negotiation rounds are really important. However, for example, you know, just to take a hypothetical, oil workers, that's a job like oil rig workers. This is a job that shouldn't exist, but a union will necessarily defend it in itself and will try to influence the national conversation to keep that sort of thing, right? And this is an example where we need to understand that just if it is enclosed, if it is siloed off, and if it is only and purely about what it's looking to, within its membership as if it is a kind of club or as if the union is something, is like an advocate or lawyer that represents a group rather than being comprised of and composed of the workers themselves and doesn't look broadly to workers everywhere, then it's going to be self-defeating and they will sabotage each other, right? And sabotage any hope for a future and kind of leave this runaway train going off the cliff. Did we have time to talk about Tim Jagoff?
Yeah. You do it.
I guess I shouldn't, but like, get owned. Like, it's depressing how little analysis there has been of the fact that ACT effectively actively hit this. You know, I think we can ascertain, or it's reasonable to come to the conclusion that ACT tried to cover it up and tried to get the victims not to come forward and try to get them to sign NDAs and so on and so forth. And how involved, we knew that Seymour knew about it, how involved he was in trying to silence them, we don't know. We can speculate. But I think it's worth noting that ACT is the kind of place that, it's libertarians, okay? I'm just going to say it, all right? I know it's a slur, but they're libertarians. Actually, it's a Febophilia, et cetera, et cetera. And we shouldn't be shocked. Which I don't want to devalue any of the victims. And in fact, I hope that more, if they do exist, come forward, not just for them, but for others as well. But I do want to say that it's disheartening that the media isn't really questioning this sort of thing. Because again, like factually, we know that David Seymour, Snapchat's minors, doesn't see a problem with that. That's the kind of attitude which allows abuse to flourish, right? And so it means that when people will be doing these things, and you know, Young ACT had some scandals in respect of this as well, they may not care that much about it so long as the money's still coming in, so long as they have their positions, so long as they can still be taking a wrecking ball to the country, right? Like, it kind of doesn't matter. I'm not saying it's part and parcel or a necessity that ACT is like rife with pedophiles. What I'm saying is that what I just said before, which is not that and not defamatory.
Hashtag not all libertarians.
Not all libertarians.
Yeah, I mean, for anyone who's been living under a rock, Timothy William, probably, let's assume, Jago, and indecently assaulted two teenagers. He'd been mentoring in a sports club between 1995 and 1999. And over the last 2 years, year and a half, has had name suppression since he was found guilty. And that's just been lifted last night. So we're looking at a world in which people can finally start asking ACT questions about the process behind that and how the name suppression part of it is probably kind of the most politically salient in a kind of electoral sense, because he had name suppression during the 2023 election. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see to what degree that was supported by various political actors, let's say. And Rawiri Waititi, the Māori Party co-leader, was censured by Parliament for challenging act harbouring, I think he used the word, child molester. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that kind of plays out in the media. It's, you know, it's a Friday news dump. They're doing it before Waitangi. It's exactly when you would dump something that you wanted people to get over but you knew was going to come out. It's, you know, a long, long time before they're sitting again. It's, you know, it's perfect kind of burial material. But we know that a bunch of journalists will have already got their articles written, right? So it still will kind of see which way the chips fall.
But it's flavor of the day. I mean, this is something which will pass, and I think will many things will go unsaid, which is a problem.
Yeah.
Because, because, you know, if Dawoodi can be censured, and this is, you know, even under parliamentary privilege, right? And ordinary people can have, and we, you know, we make jokes about defamation, but act as litigious, and they will jealously guard against any sort of criticism. And in respect of that, it is worth noting that, you know, like we joke about it and we couch them, think these in kind of comic terms. There is a real chilling effect that goes on. And what's crucial to understand is that if ACT doesn't want to talk about it, and ACT does not want to talk about it, and there is a chilling effect where ordinary people don't want to talk about it, or we have a kind of threat of tools like defamation hanging over us, this is part of what perpetuates abuse itself, is that enforced silence and the tools of the kind of existing hierarchies which facilitate that sort of thing, right? People can't come forward because they are afraid of what will happen to them. And it's not just media pylons, and it's not just the intense scrutiny. You know, we think about the intense bravery of someone like Gisèle Bellicot, right? Because this is the rare person who lays their entire life bare for the benefit of others. And that is like hashtag inspiring, like hashtag liberalism. But like in many respects, it is something where you can't expect that of people, and people shouldn't have to do that, but they have to. And you can't expect people to either, like, one, be angels as victims, or two, just have to go through the mill, right? Or anybody else to talk about it and make it, make the culture okay to be able to let this stuff come to light. These were, you know, not to the people who suffered them in many ways, but they were, definitionally and legally historic, right? The Muriwai Surf Club, I understand, was where this had taken place, yeah, which was some time ago in the 90s. I'm sorry to tell all of you that the 90s was some time ago. I know that that's a really shocking thing to have to hear all the time. But, you know, but there are contemporary cases which are going on right now, and many of those will not be heard because people can't come forward, because the reaction to this and these historic cases and the fear of litigation, the fear of not being heard, not being listened to, and all of the other fears that go around it, not being supported by people, or any of the other fears, as I say, exist. And so people will look at the reaction to what is happening now. People who are in situations which they shouldn't be, or may not even understand, are wrong as it's happening to them, you know, right now. And they won't come forward for that reason, because they see what happens. So the job of media, in part, is not only to shed light on this, not only to ask questions, but not to just have this as a horse race thing, right? Where are we going after, oh, there's a weakness, there's a chink in the armor, there's blood in the water. Yeah, let's tear into ACT for a few days or maybe a couple of weeks so that we can kind of satisfy ourselves and then move on, and then that's it. And it's specifically just about this party, because it is about Tim Jago, but it's not just about Tim Jago. And when people who are victims see that, they are, if that's all it is, I think many of them will be discouraged from coming forward, is all I will say.
Oh, for sure. I think that's really well put. And I mean, we saw this a few years ago. I know it's gross, for want of a better word, to make kind of qualitative comparisons, but from a media perspective, there was the, as you already alluded to, the Young ACT kind of allegations of a culture of misogyny and kind of minimization of young women's complaints, and worse. And then also the Young Labour camp investigation. And that was treated as a horse race in quite like an unpleasant way, because it was perfect for the media, right? It had this kind of both sides element. It had this, you can ask questions about it without, I guess, getting any deeper, right? It's a really easy story for the media to kind of run with, and then just drop, which I just hope doesn't become, I guess it already is the culture, but there's something really kind of perverse, I think, about the way that we treat that. And it shouldn't be a horse race thing, right? It is like, it's an individual person, but also more importantly, like the victims and survivors of these circumstances will struggle. And there's, and if we had an organization that was worth its name, some kind of free speech representing organization, maybe they'd be having difficult conversations about the role of freedom of expression when you can get censured in parliament with the benefit of parliamentary privilege for breaking one of these kind of silencing effects, right? And the pall that casts over potential future allegations or people coming forward in quite like a heroic way and having to lay themselves there is quite nasty. But the converse of that is there is a value, right? It's not never that it makes sense to hold these kind of to not be able to say these people's names because they're connected to victims and people can draw conclusions. So I think it's a difficult conversation to get right, and not one that I at all trust the media to be able to do correctly without making it kind of hit piece of the day.
I am not actually hugely against things like name suppression in principle, but it's only because the media environment that exists, and this has sort of been recognized by the Supreme Court, is acrimonious and doesn't lead to justice. It makes the closest thing that people have to feeling like justice is doing a pile on or something like that. Sometimes this gets called by like poor actors, I think, in bad faith, as like mob mentality or something like that. But we see that usually in a field where something like social media exists, the people who suffer the most tend to be people who are already in some respect disadvantaged within the social hierarchy, right? So you'll probably actually be kind of okay if you're a cis white man or something like that. But for others, it becomes harder and less good. Yeah. So in a world, in an ideal world, it wouldn't even need to be in question that, these sorts of revelations could exist and be talked about and dealt with healthily and normally. But the stigma that's associated with it is also one of the reasons why, even for historic cases, and this is in part, and I'm getting probably into the weeds with criminal justice here, but some of the tariff cases are so high that there is no advantage to pleading guilty, even when you should, right? And this is not to say that, it's not right for everybody to have justice or to go through and have a trial, but you think about how arduous this is, and it's arduous for the defendant as well, but the victims, my God, like a child victim having to go through our adversarial system. Fuck me if we haven't created the torment nexus for children. And prosecutors that, at least the ones that, and I hope they're not listening to this, but at least a lot of the ones that I've dealt with, they are not competent enough to be able to like guide children well through that sort of system. Many of them are people just who are in their 20s who are just seeing this as a job that they go through at the Crown or something like that, and they're just not equipped, and we don't care. This is the problem, right? Is that we have a one size fits all system, which makes sense if you have, like this sort of adversarial trial system makes sense for like a murder, but for sex crimes, it's really not a solution at all. And our forms of justice just don't make sense. And they are hard on everybody and don't create good results or outcomes, because the only solution that we ever have to anything is prison, which is just kind of like putting somebody in a box or in a cage for a while to just be like, sit in the naughty corner and be like mildly tortured for a while. And it's like, this doesn't actually ameliorate anything. This doesn't prevent this happening in the future. None of it. Like, it doesn't address any of it. It doesn't make the victims feel better. It doesn't make the defendants better people. Nothing. Nothing good comes out of this. It just makes society, it just scratches the kind of revenge itch a little bit, except not properly, because we're still not, like, we're not hanging people anymore. So, it doesn't properly get at it, right? But none of this, nothing about any of these situations works. And what's worse is that oftentimes people who are abused know their abuser. And if they know that the likely outcome is that this person is going to be put into like the torture box, they may not want that to happen, right? And this prevents people from understanding the stigma around the idea of like sexual harm and abuse. And it just occurs to me, we need to put a content warning at the very start of this episode because we're talking about this, is so great that people might even think, oh, you know, like this stuff happened to me and it was really bad and like I have trauma about it. But, you know, like, oh, this person wasn't like, they weren't, you know, and again, content warning for everybody. They're not a rapist or something like that, because in our minds, that's like some media depiction for many people of truly the most horrible thing you could imagine happening in some kind of like sore torture porn, right? But it's not. And there are gradations of this, and they affect everybody in different ways, and we devalue ourselves because of that. And so every part of this doesn't matter. People will not come forward because they think, oh, well, this is gonna happen to them. I don't want this to happen to them, you know. I want justice, but that's not justice for me, sort of thing. And also, I don't want to have to go through it, you know?
Yeah, no, exactly. And as an indication of that, I mean, if you know anyone in the criminal justice system in this kind of mold, ask them whether and how they would report personal abuse, right? And very often you'll get quite uncomfortable answers about like, oh no, like it would have to be so bad before I would recommend somebody like reporting this to the police, because the amount of the kind of agonizing, excruciating, institutionalized, bureaucratized, Kafkaesque element to this that you have to fucking live through is not worth the torment until the threshold is like unbearably high. Yeah, so just horrible all around.
And this has got better, and I will say that the way that it is, judges are a lot better about this now, but again, it's still an adversarial system, so it's still bad. But question like cross-examination, for example, a lot better, especially for child victims. However, many of the old style barristers are still around, because guess what, young people get burnt out of the law, and so they leave. Like all the good people you want to be in law, like those, they're leaving. So you still have these people who've been doing it for 30 years and they still basically just get up and they're like, you're a lying hussy, aren't you? Like, you know, like, and they'll get told off by the judge, but you've already done it, you know. You've already subjected a kid or somebody who, you know, had this done to them when they were a kid and are older now and kind of get transported back to that. And that nobody wants to have that happen to them, you know? So this sort of stuff still happens and still bad. And there is no real good way of doing it, unfortunately, within the way the justice system works. We're quite over time, so I won't go into a rant about MOJ or about like the courts or anything like that. But safe to say, as somebody sort of at the coalface, it's not good, and there are a lot of reasons why people don't come forward, and we really need to make it a situation where people can.
No, I think that's a fantastic first person perspective to bring as well. Yeah, and I won't get into my rant about mob mentality and cancel culture. That can be next episode that I'm on, so probably next year, right, folks?
The woke mob is coming after us. Damn.
As always. Thanks, Simone. Do you want to plug anything? Let's wrap.
Oh, no, not for now. Don't follow me, because this will probably make a lot of people mad. So don't do that. Don't find me.
Hate DMs, send to my Twitter account, PMAX.
Yeah, send any complaint mail to Kyle D. Church.
Yeah, he loves it. He loves it. He gets off on it to an uncomfortable degree. PMAX, do you want to plug anything?
No, nothing in particular. Just keep looking after yourselves.
Catch up on the wild rides.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to get back into that.
The rides are increasingly wild. Thanks, everyone. That's been another episode of 1 of 200. We've gone long because we're hardcore. Thanks, everybody. Have a wonderful week leading up to Waitangi. Make your Waitangi plans. See a comrade. High five someone. Smile at someone on the street. It's been 1 of 200. We'll catch you next week.
Artifices are then I'm living a pointless life, but I'm learning all your lessons from your politics. There's no distinction, the words upon now. It's paid with good intentions, and I'll admit that I'm at a loss for what to say when they criticize a cloth you ought to stay. Cause I live amongst the people every day. This vindictive, forgetful fucking rain. It feels like we're all